Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 25th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Eucharist, Learning Table Manners in a Broken World, presented by Mark Burrows, number BUM 2005-01. Let's listen in.
So they turn the tape on and the CD.
Glad you're here, and I want to say a little bit about myself and what we're going to do for the next few days if you have the courage and the fortitude to hang in there with me. I'm Mark Burrows. I'm by training a historian, in fact a medieval historian. So most of my professional work is in ancient culture long ago and far away. But for as long as I can remember, I've been passionately interested in literature and the arts, and I currently direct the program in Worship, Theology, and the Arts at Andover Newton Theological School in Boston, where I teach on the faculty. What we're going to do in the next couple of days together is to think about the Eucharist, or the sacrament of the table, or the supper, the Last Supper, the Lord's Supper, communion, whatever way you describe it. But we're going to try to gain an access to an early Christian practice that is, at least to my mind, dimly visible, if at all, in many of our communities of faith. So we're going to be reading backwards into the earliest Christian century, the earliest Christian experience, to try to have some sense of what it was like for at least the communities Paul knew to gather around a supper and to remember the presence of Jesus in this supper. And we're going to do it through the arts. So every day, every session, we'll have a poem in front of us, or a couple of days we'll be looking at clips from films. Well, that's my cue. All right. Hey, you're welcome. That's my cue, so if it's not rolling already, let it roll. So we're going to try to gain some sense of early Christian practice of the supper, because I think one of the radical things that early Christians discovered to do, it was something unfamiliar to them, it was new, and it was a place where they found their identity. And we're going to do it through the lens of the arts, contemporary arts. We're going to listen to some music, some Bruce Springsteen of all things. We're going to listen to, watch a couple of clips, including one today, and we're going to hear some poetry, read some poetry together. So I'm going to talk for a bit, just kind of set up what we're doing, and then we're going to watch a clip from Beloved, which is a movie version of Toni Morrison's award-winning novel called Beloved. I don't know how many of you have seen that movie. They had a very short run in the theaters. I think it was too hard a movie for North American culture. Oprah Winfrey has a starring role together with Danny Glover, incredible actress. And it is a movie that is a disturbing image of what it means to live in a racist culture. It's all set in the 1870s, so it's a few years back. And I'll set the movie up in a few minutes. But first I want to think about why in the world I may be teaching this class here at Holden. Communion, Eucharist, seems like something dimly relevant to what it might mean for us to live in an increasingly dangerous world. A fragile world, a broken world. To me, the images that come from the practice of communion are really at the heart of what it might mean to envision being Christian in our time. And I hope that by entering a different imaginary, if you will, a different way of imagining communion in the next few days together, we'll find insights, courage, passion perhaps, to think about how we break bread, how we share the cup. This cup of blessing, this cup of new covenant, not only together in our communities, but how we see ourselves gathered around one table in the world, because we really do. We live in one world. And in a sense, metaphorically, we all live around one table. There is no second table or third table. There's one table that we share, and this early Christian image that's so central in Paul, that the church is one body, lies really at the heart of what I'm going to be thinking with us together for the next couple of days. I think of the church really as a place of a radical imagination. And if it isn't that, it isn't church. It may be a useful place to gather for therapy or even for modest projects of mission. But if we're not cultivating a radical imagination, a very different way of imagining the world we live in, then the chances are we're at least not in conversation with Jesus and with the early Christians. And that may be part of our challenge to remember Jesus, to remember, when we gather at this table, the living Jesus, the Jesus who was difficult, who was dangerous to the status quo, who was disturbing to the good religious people, like us, who turned over tables in the temple, who really envisioned something other than a kind of slavish obedience to tradition. In fact, he's rewriting tradition. And when we hear the Sermon on the Mount, those words that frame these sayings, these radical sayings, some of which Steve read this morning at breakfast for those who were here, we don't realize how a Jew of Jesus' day would have heard these. You have heard that it was said. And then Jesus begins to speak words of the law. But I say to you, it's an act of engaging the tradition and remaking it. And to me, that's the heart of what it is to be Christian, to engage the tradition, not to set it aside, but to engage it deeply enough to dare to change ourselves, to risk changing, to risk leaving our gatherings with a different imagination, a deeper imagination, a bolder imagination, and I would risk saying a truer imagination than the one we gain from the world we live in, and often the church we live in. So at stake this morning, instead of this afternoon, the title, Imagining Real Presence, it's a provocative title, maybe it doesn't strike you that way, but usually when you hear the word real presence, what do you think? What does that conjure up as a place of conversation, real presence?
Something genuine about God.
Something genuine about God, yeah. And in the church's tradition, there's been a place of conversation around real presence, which is what happens, right, in the Eucharist. I mean, this was at the heart of a long struggle and debate in the Middle Ages, long before the Reformation.
Didn't Luther talk about in, with, and under?
That's right.
I always liked that phrase.
In, with, and under. That's right. There was a big, and Luther's part now, really, of a debate in the Western Church that's been going on for five centuries. For 500 years before Luther, Christians were debating what it meant that Christ was really present in the sacrament. And most of us, in a way, we're conditioned to think that the debate is about what happens on the table or on the altar. And in point of fact, that conversation is nowhere visible in the early church, nowhere. When Paul, and we'll get to this by the end of the week, when Paul talks about discerning the body, he's talking about not what happens on the table, but what happens in the community. And Paul's imagination really isn't to worry about whether Jesus is truly present or really present or symbolically present on the table, but whether Jesus' image, Jesus' reality, is taking shape in the community. That's an incredibly different way of asking the question. And I hope that this week won't just be a kind of an example of arcane wondering, but really a chance for us together to imagine what it might be like for us to dare to risk believing that what's at stake when we gather is not what happens on the table, but what happens around the table. What happens in the community of the believers, of the faithful. So that's the kind of grand plan, and we'll go through these various images today. And we're going to go very slowly through a few lines from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, his first letter to the Corinthians. It may be that this letter is itself comprised of a number of letters put together by early Christian communities that remembered Paul. That revered Paul's authority, it may be. At stake in the church in Corinth, if you think about the church in Corinth, what does Paul tell us at the very beginning of the letter? What was happening in this church? What do you know? Do you remember?
Well, Corinth was a pretty
Yeah, it's a port city. And as is true in many places where ships are coming and going, where news is traveling back and forth, where people are coming and going, where sailors are coming and going, it's not a place of great moral virtue. It's not a place known as a community of great moral virtue. It's a tough place. And the community in Corinth was a difficult community. In fact, Paul begins the letter, not as he does the letter to the Philippians. He loves the Philippians. They're easy. They're an easy community. They're a community he loves. He's welcome there. They're getting it. They know what to do, apparently, and he's happy with them. The Corinthians are messed up. And then what's their basic problem? Well, morality is a big issue, and division. They're divided. They have all of these different groups, apparently, and they're just starting out. He didn't know what it was to be Christian. There wasn't any tradition. That's the amazing thing. When we read these letters, we lose a sense of the drama of these early so-called Pauline communities, these communities Paul wrote to. They didn't have traditions to fall back on. They didn't have a long experience. And remember, these are Christians, people now, who are not living in a Jewish community. They're in a Gentile world. Corinth is not has Jews, in fact, living there, but it's a Gentile community. It's a community, a worldly community. And their problem is, well, licentiousness, all kinds of immorality, and division. And so one of the things Paul is trying to do is help them understand how important it is to come together to form, I think, one of the most radical images for Paul that emerges, which really comes from his work in Corinth, is the image of the church as a single body. We kind of take it for granted. 1 Corinthians 12, church is one body with many members. For Paul, this was a kind of therapeutic image. It was a prophetic image for this community, deeply divided, to realize that they belong to each other. That to be Christian meant you had to figure out how to belong at the places of your division, in the heart of the community's darkness, at the place of the community's struggle. It wasn't trying to figure out how to be Christian on the other side of that, but it was how to be Christian at the very place of division, of brokenness. So that's the kind of the framework, the social framework of this letter. And when Paul turns to help this group of Christians, young Christians, understand how they might learn to be Christian together, you have your Bible, you can open to 1 Corinthians 11. We'll look just for a few moments at this text, and then we're going to turn to a film and open up the conversation by looking at another moment of division and struggle. So 1 Corinthians 11, remember there weren't chapters and verses for Paul, this is just part of a long letter. And he is at verse 17 and following, beginning to talk about some of the abuses, the difficulties that were happening when Christians gathered they weren't celebrating communion. That's a modern word. They weren't even celebrating a sacrament. That's not a word Paul would have known. It's a Latin word. Paul's word was mystery. Mysterium tebu, the mystery of God. They were there to celebrate a mystery. And it was a mystery that involved a memory. It was a mystery centered on a memory. That by itself, if you don't get anything more from this class or leave today and wander in other directions, it's the memory of Jesus. It's so central for Paul. And when we hear those words, do this in memory of me or in remembrance of me. Do this remembering me. What I'd like to suggest is Paul meant something different than the way we think of memory. Paul meant, how do we represent Jesus? How do we visually and experientially discover Jesus' presence again, which is what Paul knew memory to be? How do we make it present again? How do we make Jesus present again? And I hope if you're following these wonderful classes with Barbara Rossing, these might serve as sort of bookends of the same project. How do we remember Jesus? Not how do we get a mental construct in our mind. That's a modern way of thinking of memory. In the ancient world, to remember something is to make it present again. How do you make Jesus present at the table? That's Paul's question. That's his question. Not how are you thinking. How do you make Jesus present? And remember, Paul isn't interested in what the priest is doing. He doesn't even have that language to talk about this mystery. There's no word of priests in this letter. No word of a priest or a minister presiding at a meal. No, we have a very different vision of what happens. This community is coming together. Well, we'd almost call it potluck supper, which I've always thought of as the great Protestant sacrament. Really. I mean, it's the one distinctive modern Protestant sacrament that we have. It's where our community really forms most acutely. Maybe that in the 12-step program. They meet downstairs in the basement on Thursday evenings or Sunday afternoons. Those are the sacraments that we discover. Now, for Paul, it wasn't what the priest did, it was what the community did when it gathered to remember Jesus. So we'll come back to this tomorrow. But let's look just for a moment at the way Paul sets this up. He talks about the abuses at the Lord's Supper in 1 Corinthians 11, verses 17 and following. We'll come back to this on the last days together. The last days here at Holden. My last days. Because for him, it's a bad potluck supper. I mean, that's the image. It's a broken body because some people come, they apparently brought their own food, and they ate a meal together. That's the image we have in Paul's, in this image from Corinthians. They brought food to the church, to the gathering, to the household, wherever that was. They brought their food and they ate together and they remembered Jesus at the meal. Just as Jesus gathered with his disciples, his followers, and ate a meal before there was a sharing of the bread and of the cup. Now what happens? Some, the wealthy apparently, bring a lot of food and eat until they're probably well fed and drunk, and the poor sit and watch. Pretty bad image of potluck supper. I've never been to one like that. But that's what happened. And so the challenge for Paul is to help his community realize how they belong to each other, that if one is hungry, they aren't remembering Jesus. If some are filled and some are hungry, they may be doing something interesting, but they're not remembering Jesus of Nazareth. They're not remembering this Jesus. So that's where we're headed. And that's why I'm going to talk about this class as learning a different kind of table manners and thinking about the way we celebrate communion around one table in our world, where when some are hungry and some are fed, there's something wrong with the memory of Jesus. So, one verse today, and we'll watch a bit of a movie and talk about it. It's chapter 11, verse 23. Somebody read that?
For I received from the Lord what I also handed on to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took a loaf of bread.
Okay, stop there. That's great, John. This is a verse packed with so much. Paul is telling this community, they don't have much tradition. They're new Christians. They're just learning how to do it. But he's saying, I already received this. This is tradition. This was given to me. I didn't make it up. It's given to me. I received from the Lord what I also handed on to you. But the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took a loaf of bread. Now, this is the one moment. You know, there are three other versions of the supper. John doesn't have one. Fourth Gospel doesn't have a last supper. There's a supper in the middle of the gospel, but it's not at the end of the story. In Matthew and Mark and Luke, there are these stories of the last supper. And what happens around the last supper with the disciples? There's an act of betrayal, right? None of those accounts add what Paul does on the night in which he was betrayed. That they don't have to, because the narrative tells us that. Who betrays Jesus?
Judas Iscariot.
Judas, that's the obvious one. Judas betrays Jesus with a kiss.
So does Peter.
So does Peter.
Nice.
All of the disciples finally are gone at the end of the story, except the women. They're the only ones who don't betray Jesus, the women. And tradition has developed a different collection of women around the cross. But the disciples have all fled in fear. And Mark ends his gospel at that place, startlingly. The oldest manuscript we have of the apparently the oldest gospel ends with the disciples trembling with fear. There is no resurrection appearance in the oldest manuscript of Mark's gospel. It ends with fear. And in a way, that's where the story does end. That's where it ends. Betrayal. In one sense, the story of Jesus. These expectations of what Jesus would do as a revolutionary, as a prophet, as a healer, as a teacher, they all seem to end at Golgotha, at this place of the skull, of the cross. That story is finished. And at that point, all of the disciples who were the noteworthy ones, the men in the story, betrayed Jesus. Judas first, and all the rest. And I think that when I think about communion, to me, our supper, the way we remember Jesus, I think it's important that we realize that every time we gather at this table, we gather in the strong possibility of betrayal, of our betrayal, of our refusal to really listen, to receive this radical word from Jesus, to hear it, and to risk changing our lives. And so this, when Paul begins to tell the story, the first thing he tells the Corinthians is, it was a night of betrayal. And we know from reading the letter that this was a community of betrayal. And I would say it's just like every church I know, that there's always the element of betrayal present for all of us. It's our humanness. Lutherans know this best of all. At least Luther knew this so clearly. We always, in fact, I was thinking after the last night, this marvelous sermon that Emily preached, when she asked, were you among the useless fish or among the useful fish, right? The answer should have been yes to both. That's Luther's answer. Yeah, I'm a useless fish. And yeah, I'm a useful fish. Simul justus et peccator. I'm at once justified and a sinner. I don't know myself as anything other than sinful. But thanks be to God, I also know myself as grace. I live in that contradiction. And so when I say every time we gather at the table, we gather in the presence of betrayal, I mean that in a strong sense, but not a defeating sense. It means every time we gather, we gather as sinners. We gather as the weak, as those who may not bear the burden of following Jesus, of living out the gospel. But that's only part of the story. So let's think about this betrayal and this gift. And what I'd like to do is show a short clip from this film, marvelous film, by Toni Morrison. But we need help, because the movie makers left out some of the best parts. So here's from the book some of the parts that didn't get into the movie. And we'll read just a paragraph, and we'll watch a clip, and then we'll talk a bit about it, and then we'll read the rest of the story as Toni Morrison wrote it.
Do you have any more that you can send up here at all?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well,
how am I going to get them up? It's like
one of those emails.
Call out the window. Yep. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this novel, which is one of the great classic novels of our time. It's also an extremely difficult novel to read. But here's the setting. It opens in the 1870s in Cincinnati, Ohio. And Cincinnati was a place where slaves already before the Civil War were trying to escape, to find some level of freedom. And so the novel plays back and forth with a community of slaves who had been freed, but some of them left their slave keepers before emancipation. And so they were fugitives. And the central character in the story, a woman named Setha, who's played by Oprah Winfrey in the movie, is one of these slaves. She finally, in the agony and anguish of living under a tyrant slave master on a plantation in Kentucky, flees north and crosses the river and finds refuge in a community of former slaves outside of Cincinnati. And she brings her children with her, two boys and two girls, one of whom is an infant. And what we discover as the movie goes on is that eventually, when the slave master comes north to find her, because she has stolen property, she is property still of the slave master. In a fit of rage, of fear, she begins to kill her children because she doesn't want them to experience the degradation, the obscene violence that she lived out in her body. It's a scene that's difficult to imagine for all of us, but there it is. She successfully kills the youngest, who's not yet been named, who's just been born. Her daughter escapes, and the two boys, who are unscathed by the murder, by the infanticide, quite quickly flee themselves and leave, and she never sees them again. So the scene we're going to see happens just before this event. And this marks Setha. I mean, she's now criminalized, she's put in jail, and so that even when emancipation happens, she's jailed. And she's living with a horrible stigma of being a murderer of her own child. And so she's completely ostracized from the African-American community and from the white world. She lives the last part of her life really isolated and alone on the home that her mother-in-law owned. The scene we're going to see is a scene that takes us back to that month or so before this terrible event, when the slaves, or the former slaves, would go out to a place called the clearing. And the old woman, who's called Baby Suggs Holy, you'll meet her here, the mother, Setha's mother-in-law, would preach to them. There's only a little part that's included in the movie, so I brought the text, so we'll read it together, and then we'll think about what the trail means. Because to me, understanding what happens in communion is all about what happens in the possibility of betrayal, betraying the gift of God, the gift of Jesus, the gift of grace, the gift of forgiveness, and how hard it is to receive this gift. So let's look at this. Who'd like to read the first paragraph? And 124 is simply the name of the house where Baby Suggs lives, and where Setha then comes to live with her children. That's the number of the house, and they simply, Morrison refers to it simply as 124. Who'd like to read? Well, just the first paragraph.
It was in front of that 124 that Setha climbed off a wagon, her newborn tied to her chest, and felt for the first time the wide arms of her mother-in-law, who had made it to Cincinnati. Who decided that, because slave life had busted her legs, back, head, eyes, hands, kidneys, womb, and tongue, she had nothing left to make a living with but her heart, which she put to work at once. Accepting no title of honor before her name, but allowing a small caress after it, she became an unchurched preacher, one who visited pulpits and opened her great heart to those who could use it. In winter and fall, she carried it to AMEs and Baptists, Holinesses and Sanctifieds, the Church of the Redeemer and the Redeemed. Uncalled, unrobed, unanointed, she let her great heart beat in their presence. When warm weather came, Baby Suggs, Holy, followed by every black man, woman, and child who could make it through, took her great heart to the clearing. A wide open place cut deep in the woods. Nobody knew for what at the end of a path known only to deer and whoever cleared the land in the first place. In the heat of every Saturday afternoon, she sat in the clearing while the people waited among the trees.
Okay, well, there's this thing. It's not a church. It's a gathering place. It's called the clearing. And as we learn later in the novel, it became later a place for white revivals with all of the sort of equipment and all the trappings that connotated. But at this point, it's where these blacks gathered. And she would gather in the middle of them. So we're going to see a little clip from that. And you'll hear the first part of the dialogue here. So if you could hit the button twice up there above you. Mark, do you have any knowledge on that?
All I know is I just hit it once and let it warm up first before I hit that thing. So I think if you hit it twice, you might have turned it on and back off again.
Okay. So what should we do?
I just wind the film back to the beginning and just let this be on and off a bit until that little...
Came on right away before we queued it up.
So of course.
Let's try turning it off.
Turn it off.
Turn
it back on. Yeah, two to turn it off and one to turn it on.
Yeah, turn it back on and let it warm up.
Just push it once.
It's all powering out. No!
Go in there! Who's that back there?
No, we need some technical support here. It's playing, it's just not getting the video.
You know how to turn it on? That, you know what the on button is?
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Searching.
Vamp it.
Okay. So here we go. She's taking now her daughter, Denver, and Beloved is another character I haven't talked about, to the clearing, to remember what happened at the clearing.
Coming and going all the time. It's a happy house when I first got there. In the stretch of the chest. Waiting on her daddy to come.
Daddy.
Daddy bought baby Soaks' feeling. Sleeping in already, busted her legs, busted her back, hands, everything. When she come here, she ain't had nothing left to make no living with. Besides her heart.
This is her mother, mother-in-law, baby Suggs.
Baby Suggs used to preach right here.
Let the children come. Let your mother hear you laugh. So that's as much as we get in the film. The beginning of the sermon, of this moment, of the children being invited to come out and laugh, and then the grown men to come out and dance, and then the women to come out and weep. And I want to read with you the rest of what Toni Morrison gives of this scene, because it's really quite a remarkable scene. At the very bottom of the page, it started that way. Laughing children, dancing men, crying women. And then it got all mixed up. Women stopped crying and danced. Men sat down and cried. Children danced, women laughed. Children cried until exhausted and riven. All and each lay about the clearing, damp and gasping for breath. In the silence that followed, Baby Soaks Holy offered up to them her great big heart. She did not tell them to clean up their lives or to go and sin no more. She did not tell them they were the blessed of the earth, its inheriting meek, or its glory-bound pure. She told them that the only grace they could have was the grace they could imagine, that if they could not see it, they would not have it. Here, she said, in this here place, we flesh, flesh that weeps, laughs, flesh that dances on bare feet and grass, love it hard. Yonder they do not love your flesh. They despise it. They don't love your eyes. They just as soon pick them out. No more do they love the skin on your back. Yonder they flay it. And oh my people, they do not love your hands. Those they only use, tie, bind, chop off, and leave empty. Love your hands, love them. Raise them up and kiss them. Touch others with them and pat them together, stroke them on your face, because they don't love that either. You got to love it. You. You got to love it. You. I'm going to break off at that moment. This is a remarkable scene in so many ways. In the book, it's fairly early on in the story. In the movie version, it comes pretty late. What you realize is that, in a way, this is the gift. This is the offering of the gift. Well, Toni Morrison doesn't call it grace. She calls it loving ourselves, loving the beauty that God gave us. In a world that doesn't love it. And these are slaves, after all, who've been, many of them, destroyed physically, emotionally, battered, uprooted, silenced, killed, many of them. And I grew up in the South in the 1950s, and as a child I still remember a lynching in my town. 1958. I was a little boy. So here's the way she sets up the story, and what happens in what follows is that, for the most part, these now freed slaves can't receive the gift. They don't trust it. And Setha, most of all, who's a battered, ruined woman, who's isolated from her own community, who has no home. She's homeless in the strongest sense. She has no community among the blacks, among the whites. She's no one. And the whole story is really about the possibility of redemption. The possibility of still receiving a gift this large. Carrying the burden, oh, not of sin, but of evil. The effect of evil on the body. Now, it's strange. Why watch this film? Why think about it reading St. Paul the Apostle, and why this section from 1 Corinthians? In some ways, Paul is, I wouldn't quite say obsessed with the body, but he's so concerned about the body in the letter to the Corinthians, about the body as a temple of God, the body as a pure gift, and not defiling the body. This movie isn't about defiling the body, it's about the body defiled and hated and ruined by others. But the story, I think, is the same one for Paul. And when he uses the image of the body to talk about the church, he's thinking about all the anguish and the agony and the betrayal that the body carries. And this community knows about that anguish and about that betrayal. They know that. That's a story they know best. And Paul is trying to tell them a new story, a new real, a new presence, a new memory, a new imagination. And the question really is, will they find the courage? Will they find the courage to receive that presence? Or will they fall back on what they know, which is betrayal? So that's where we are, and at the beginning of the story of the supper, of Eucharist, of communion. Because to me, communion only makes any sense at this place. Maybe the only ones of us who ever get it right are those of us who are really crawling to the table. Not with the our virtues loudly festooned on our faces, but with our hunger and with our need for grace, for forgiveness, for love. And clearly, I think what Paul knows so powerfully is that words, getting the words right, isn't enough. How does he say it? For God's kingdom, God's reign, depends not on talk, but on power. 1 Corinthians, same letter, chapter 4. God's reign depends not on talk, but on power. I get increasingly suspicious of theological talk, and I'm one that creates a lot of it. It's kind of a casualty of the profession, I think. But I really grow increasingly weary of the talk that we do, that if we only get the talk right, we'll know what it is to be Christian. This was far from Paul's mind. Paul knew that somehow what it meant to get this meal right was to live into the gift of Jesus' presence, to become a different body than the body they knew naturally, these Corinthians. It's no different for us. And I think in some sense, the church is often very little help, much as we'd like to think differently, very little help, because how did Nietzsche put it? I believe in the Christian's God if they look more redeemed. I believe in their God if they only look more redeemed. But that thought stays with me as a kind of, not an indictment as much as a calling. And in point of fact, what Nietzsche meant by that is not if they looked happy, although he loved laughter. There ought to be a different kind of joy, a different kind of radical imagination. And in one of the most powerful stories of the gospel I know from modern literature, it's Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra, a kind of hymn of this higher God. There's an invitation similar to the one that Morrison leaves us with, and that is, we first need a different kind of imagination. The only grace you can have is the grace you can imagine. If you cannot see it, you will never have it. But just seeing it and just imagining it isn't enough. And that's what the whole rest of the novel is about. Sorry, I'm talking far too much. Tomorrow we'll have more conversation. The whole novel is really about the difficulty, the challenge of moving from imagination to reality, moving from talk to experience, moving from image to power. And so to me, communion, setting this up at the beginning, tonight, today, is really an invitation. It's a possibility of a different kind of presence, of a different kind of body, of a different kind of joy, and a very different kind of faith. A faith that, in point of fact, the lost are found, the sinful are embraced, the mourning, those who mourn, are given laughter and joy. That when we gather at the table, to me, that's the miracle. That's the miracle I'm looking for, I'm wanting, I'm desiring. So what's it look like to you? What sense do you make of this?
Tradition that I've been raised in, it's communion has always been very, you know, looked at as very personal between you mm-hmm. and a relationship with Jesus.
Right.
And what you are throwing out for our consideration of this much broader
yeah.
than that. And we need to look beyond having blinders when we go up
yeah.
to the altar and see what's around us.
Right.
And not just within the confines of that building, but around. And that's takes a little bit to change my paradigm.
Yeah. I think one of the powerful images of celebrating communion here in the village is that we're looking across the table at each other. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not looking forward, as is true in my church, forward at the minister and a few deacons who are on the other side, We're looking at each other. We're gazing at each other across this table. The reconstructed cross. Powerful. That was so moving to me last night. I'd never seen that before. The reconstruction of the cross into the table. But the question is really, what will happen to us? What will happen to us together as community? Or will we leave with an individual experience that may be very powerful and very real and important? But what will happen to the us, the plural us? That seems to be Paul's passion in this letter, when he's talking about discerning the body and remembering the body. Other reflections. Yeah.
I was in a class spring quarter, theology class, and there was some jargon going on at George Bush, and somebody threw out, and he calls himself a Christian, and I kind of stopped and thought, and we call ourselves Christian, mm-hmm. and it made me think about it. I thought it's like Oscar Romero or Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. Have they earned that title more than we have?
Yeah.
Is that the kind of radical change that?
Right. Yeah, it's easy to snub people, isn't it? It's much harder to see the, well, not just the burden, but the invitation for us. And I think that's really what Paul is getting at here. It's not to indict us. It's to say that, in one sense, there's always this gift being proffered, being offered to us, always, every time we gather. And the question really is, how do we receive it? Do we receive it? Do we receive it? Not do they receive it. They aren't very interesting to Paul. He's talking about what's happening in this particular community, which is his passionate concern in this letter. Yeah.
This is all bringing the people together at the points of their dissimilarities or their angst or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
Or their, you don't agree, that's probably the hardest place to
absolutely be. And I think, you know, in a way, Paul is aware that these divisions, he says, well, they're finally important because they'll prove where the truth finally is. And as I read that line, he's not saying which group has the truth, but can the truth emerge in the one body? Do these divisions, these groupings of people, these diversities of people, do they have the courage to see the truthfulness of their life and the way they make community together, the way they become one body with all these differences in the midst of them. You know, arguably the one most divided time in our culture, you've heard this before, is the worship time on Sunday mornings. And it's most divided when we try to celebrate the supper, communion. When Catholics are unable to commune with Protestants and Protestants with Catholics, when some Lutherans can't commune with other Lutherans, when Baptists are divided at the table, in some ways this has become the great, I think, mockery, as it were, of this original meal, this intentional, this communion of one body. But you're quite right, Terry. Fear.
And it's interesting that Holden communion is more powerful to me than any other place because having come here, and there are a lot of diverse opinions at Holden, running from the far right to the far left, it's the one place where it seems much more open, and those points come together.
Mm-hmm.
And the one aspect of it is we are sharing this no matter what our differences might
yeah.
be. And they are diverse.
Yeah.
So.
Reminds me of the image from Huckleberry Finn, you probably all read it at some point, where Huck and Jim
come upon this community along the river, and they go to church. There are these two warring families. They all bring their guns to church. They leave them at the door. And for an hour at least, they'll pray together. They'll agree to pray together. But as soon as the hour's over, they're going to get their weapons back. They're going to go at each other. And of course, this is Twain, it is most ironic. But in a sense, what ought to happen, as we gather to Holden, is not that we pick up our weapons when we leave, but that we learn a different way of being together around the table. That's why I've used this image of learning table manners. I think we do need in our churches and in our world to learn a different way of behaving around the table. Jesus' way, as it were, of behaving around the table. Jesus, who after all broke bread, knowing that the betrayal had already begun and that it would continue until his death. And so for me, there's something heartening there too. This is a meal that always happens with the possibility of our betrayal, not your betrayal or their betrayal or George Bush's betrayal, our betrayal. Always the possibility, the strong possibility, that we'll leave unchanged, or that we'll have some individual experience which might be very strong and very real, very good, but won't cause us to reflect differently on how we remember Jesus as a body, as one body. We're on one table in one world. Maybe that's the strongest image that we need to reflect on this week. That we share one world and we worship around one table. And our only survival is to recognize this. And the question, as Barbara put it earlier, is the soft or hard landing? What kind of a landing are we going to have? We're going to pause tomorrow morning early for those who want to come back. We're going to see a section from one of the great movies on Eucharist, on presence, on the sacrifice of praise and joy at Babette's feast. And then later in the morning, we're going to read a remarkable poem written just in the aftermath of 9/11 by a Polish-American poet who teaches part of the year at the University of Houston, Adam Zagajewski, remarkable writer of our time, called Try to Praise the Mutilated World. And then Wednesday, we're going to listen to a song by Bruce Springsteen from his new album, his new CD, Devils in Dust. And finally, we'll end with the last epilogue, the scene from the very end of the movie, Places in the Heart, also starring Danny Glover and John Malkovich's first role, leading role, and Sally Field, which is a kind of vision of a different table and a different community, a different body together around the table. So thanks for your courage in coming at 5, and I hope to see some of you tomorrow morning.